Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. This week's topic is an open world. With me to discuss how the United States might revamp its foreign policy is Rebecca Listener. Rebecca is an assistant professor in the Strategic and Operational Research Department at the U.S. Naval War College and a non-resident scholar at Georgetown University's Security Studies Program. Rebecca has also served as a special advisor to the Deputy Secretary of Energy during the Obama administration. She is the co-author with CFR Senior Fellow Mira Rapp Hooper of the new book, An Open World, How America Can Win the Contest for the 21st Century Order. Now, I want to note at the top that as an employee of the U.S. Naval War College, it is important to note that Rebecca is speaking only on her own behalf. Rebecca, with that caveat out of the way, thanks for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me, Jim. I'm delighted to be here.
Okay, well, let's begin with the big question. Why did you write An Open World?
So our book, An Open World, makes the case that the United States needs to reimagine its foreign policy for a post-pandemic and potentially post-Trump world before it is too late. And we began this project in the immediate wake of the 2016 election, when it was already clear to us that Donald Trump himself was more an avatar than an architect of the massive domestic and international changes that were acting upon American foreign policy. Because even if Hillary Clinton had won in 2016, she still would have had to contend with adverse global power shifts, rapid technological change, and worsening domestic political dysfunction at home. So this book set out to push back against two pieces of conventional wisdom. First, the idea that Donald Trump was himself solely responsible for the collapse of American international influence and the so-called liberal international order. And second, the idea that the United States could somehow go back to foreign policy business as usual whenever he would leave office, whether in 2021 or 2025. So by examining these long-term domestic and international trends, our book actually anticipated the foreign policy emergency that we now so clearly face, because COVID has tragically illustrated our central thesis, which is that a set of international institutions and norms and laws that were built for the challenges of the 1940s are simply not suited to the challenges and the opportunities of the 2040s. A new approach is obviously needed.
Okay, you put a lot on the table there, Rebecca. There are a lot of different ways that I can go at it. Let me begin with President Trump. Obviously, he comes to office in 2017, having campaigned on a pledge to do different things in foreign policy and to do them differently. I think he has been true to his word. I take it from your opening answer that you don't think he got it right. Tell me what he got wrong.
Donald Trump has certainly pursued a distinct vision of American strategy over the course of his first term in office, but it's simply not right for our moment. Because in order for the United States to achieve an open world, which is the guiding principle that we set out in the book, the United States needs to work very closely with its allies, a set of countries that the Trump administration has repeatedly denigrated. The United States needs to rebuild international institutions for 21st century challenges, whether that's climate or pandemics or rapidly emerging technologies, whereas the Trump administration has retreated from leadership in those institutions and in some cases has even withdrawn from them, like in the case of the Paris Agreement or the World Health Organization. And the United States needs to consider the ways in which it can make its foreign policy less ambitious, which is to say more suited to the power position it now occupies alongside a rising China, which means that American strategy should not set out to change the regime in Beijing before the Chinese people decide otherwise, and shouldn't seek to change the regimes in Iran or Venezuela, especially through military force. All of these things have been priorities of the Trump administration, but the result has been that the United States has failed as a leader in a 21st century international order. And in the absence of American leadership, authoritarian powers, and especially China, are increasingly writing the rules that will govern the future of geopolitics.
Let me pick up on that last thread, Rebecca, because it sounds like you're talking a lot about a rising China. Seems that part of President Trump's strategy has been to recognize China, Russia as well, as competitors that we have to address and confront. So is that something Trump has gotten right?
The openness strategy that is advocated in our book certainly recognizes China as the chief antagonist to an open world, because China is the only country that both has a preference for a closed international system and the means to bring it about. Now, the Trump administration has gone about this, however, in a number of wrong ways. First of all, it has unduly equated the threat posed by China and Russia, which are simply not the same, because although Russia shares China's preference for closure, it simply does not have the ability to bring that closure about in the way that China does, whether through military means or through technological forms of dominance. The Trump administration similarly has alienated America's allies, which are themselves absolutely crucial because the United States cannot defend an open world on its own. The geopolitical math is simply not in its favor. So alliances are a necessary part of that picture. And third, the United States needs to lead in writing new rules for 21st century order to prevent China from doing the same and to prevent China's authoritarian-friendly rules from triumphing. And by retreating from international institutions and really neglecting the task of order modernization, the Trump administration has effectively ceded the field to China in way too many different manners.
So if I understand you correctly, President Trump, to some extent, has identified part of the problem, the rise of China, and need to confront China and Russia. At least that's the formal strategy, though you're deeply skeptical about the specific tactics, strategies, and policies that he has pursued toward those ends. Is that a fair summary?
I think that's right, in the sense that China is the chief antagonist to openness that our strategy identifies, and at the same time, the Trump administration has neglected to meet that threat in an appropriate way.
Okay, so let's now focus on the other sort of school of thought that you're critical of. You refer to it as, you know, proponents of the liberal international order. So perhaps to begin with, you might sort of explain what you mean by that and why is it those people who want to, in some sense, have a restorationist foreign policy, whatever that means precisely, why are they wrong?
Sure. So looking historically, international order has always shifted when power has shifted, and power has been shifting for some time now. So what that means in essence is that the liberal international order, which in some ways was born in the wake of World War II, but really achieved its zenith with the end of the Cold War and the rise of American primacy, is simply no longer aligned with the power realities as they exist in the world. So since the end of the Cold War, the United States has been pursuing a grand strategy of liberal universalism, which is essentially predicated on the idea that inexorably American-style liberalism, liberal markets, liberal political systems will spread to other countries. And the central wager there was that China, in particular, by engaging in that liberal international order, would itself liberalize. Now, that wager has simply not borne out because China has risen within this liberal international order. It has not been liberalized by it. And now a more powerful China seeks to revise that order to better reflect its own preferences. So to move forward, the United States needs a new vision for international order that recognizes that it's not going to be universally liberal, universally orderly, or even fully international, but rather it's going to be highly differentiated with different scopes, different memberships. There are going to be different regional and functional orders that exist in the future. And the central task for American strategy is to set those rules that are going to govern 21st century politics and make sure that those rules continue to favor openness rather than closure.
I want to pick up on this theme of openness, but I just want to go back to a point you made because it strikes me. I'm not sure that I either follow or agree. And that is, you talk about how we have to prepare ourselves for a world in which there are a variety of regional orders and they may not all be aligned. Hasn't that been the case for the last at least 75 years, if not longer?
That certainly wasn't the animating vision of American foreign policy for the past 75 years or longer, and especially not since the end of the Cold War. Because at the peak of its power, the United States really did try to realize this end of history vision and to export liberalism to all corners of the world. So let me give you a few examples. First, in the international trade regime. So the liberal international order envisioned a common set of international trading rules within a big tent WTO. But the failure to agree on a common set of rules, for example, to address China's state-owned enterprises, has effectively now ground the WTO to a halt. So to advance the trade agenda in the future, the U.S. should no longer seek to centralize all international trade discussions within the single international institution of the WTO, but rather can seek tailored, high standards, multilateral trade agreements that actually pursue something of an outside-in approach to set new standards and set new rules for the international trade regime that may not themselves be universal, but can exert outside-in pressure on the WTO and make sure that large swaths of the global economy are covered by rules that favor openness.
So something like the Trans-Pacific Partnership that the Obama administration pursued and that became the CPTPP, the Comprehensive and Progressive Trans-Pacific Partnership under the leadership of Shinzo Abe and several others, that's an outmoded strategy?
No. So although in an openness world, we might not pursue the letter of the CPTPP, that represents the type of multilateral trade agreements that the United States could pursue going forward. And the goal for those agreements, again, would be to exert pressure on states like China to move their economies in a more open direction, but also to more expansively include areas of international trade that aren't included in the international trading order right now. For example, digital services are something that have exploded over the past several decades. And certainly right now, as everybody spends much of their professional lives on Zoom, it's striking to realize that so much digital commerce is not actually governed by existing trade agreements. So the task for the United States is to push into these ungoverned or undergoverned spaces and to write the rules before China writes different ones.
I asked the question about TPP or CPTPP because I always heard the rationale for it was precisely the one that you have laid out for your openness strategy, is that you want to create institutions that will put pressure on countries, in this case on China, to behave in a way that is conducive to America's vision or the West's vision of how business should be done. So that's why I asked that question.
Sure. And I think it's important to recognize that the openness strategy should not be read as a repudiation of everything that has come before or a repudiation of everything, for example, that the Obama administration did. So much as a recognition that the world has changed irreparably since Obama took office in 2009 and even since Trump took office in 2017. And so in crafting a way forward, the United States needs to do so on the basis of the realization that it is no longer the world's uncontested superpower and that it should not be seeking to recoup that type of military primacy. And also that this idea of liberalism spreading inexorably around the world, this liberal universalism, is not the best way to organize American strategy going forward.
Okay, so let's sort of dig down on openness as an actual strategy. What would it mean in terms of dealing with China? What would an openness strategy have a president doing in dealing with China that is different from what Donald Trump has been doing for the past 3.5 years and different from what Barack Obama did during his 8 years or George Bush in the 8 years before that?
So just to be clear about what we're talking about here, an openness strategy is a vision for how the United States can secure its dearest interests and values, even though it is no longer the world's uncontested superpower. And that means that it should pursue an open world, which is to say interactions between states characterized by openness and transparency and international institutions of the same character. So in service of this objective, an openness strategy promotes the ability of all states to make free and independent political choices. It promotes the accessibility of the global commons, and it promotes transparent governance through modernized international institutions. By contrast, there are several things it opposes. It opposes the domination by hostile states of any vital global region. It opposes interference in domestic political processes by foreign powers. And it opposes any attempts to shutter vital waterways or information spaces to outside access. So an openness strategy recognizes that China has risen at a really rapid clip over the past several decades and that its military has modernized in parallel, which has resulted in the condition of the United States now facing a peer competitor in Asia. This is a very different position than the one that the United States enjoyed for much of the post-Cold War period. And so in order to live alongside a more powerful China, the United States needs a framework for understanding which types of Chinese behavior behaviors, or as some people might call it, what types of Chinese revisionism are actually a threat to the United States and needs to be strenuously opposed, and what types of Chinese behaviors are in some ways the natural outgrowth of its greater power and influence and therefore need to be nudged in the direction of greater openness. And this is another place where I think there is a really strong contrast to be drawn, not just with the Trump administration, the strategy towards China of which has been in many ways rather incoherent, but also with the Obama administration. Because in many ways, the Obama administration got this exactly backwards. Thinking back to those years, China, in building islands in the South China Sea, was actually engaging in a type of behavior that did portend closure of one of the world's most vital waterways. And yet the Obama administration, in many ways, underreacted to that threat. By contrast, China's effort to start the AIIB, a new investment and development bank, was not itself an attempt at closure, but rather a fairly reasonable expression of China's desire to pursue entrepreneurship in the institutional space and to pioneer a new type of Asian development institution. The Obama administration boycotted AIIB when in fact it should have been trying to nudge it in the direction of greater openness and transparency, a strategy ultimately that our allies pursued to great success. So like any grand strategy, the goal of an openness approach is to help policymakers make those choices, to recognize those areas where a more powerful China does pose a real threat to the United States, and to recognize those areas where it doesn't and help us allocate resources accordingly.
So looking forward then, rather than back, what are the two or three areas you say this is where the United States must oppose China because China is seeking to close down the system or keep out the United States? What would top your list?
Yeah, so it's a really interesting question, and it's important to think about this in 21st century terms, because the way in which we've often talked about and thought about spheres of influence, which the United States has long opposed, reflects in many ways a 20th or even 19th century view of how geopolitics operate. So in the first instance, the United States should oppose any attempt by China to establish a closed territorial sphere of influence, whether that's through outright military domination or other means. We should make sure that China is not able to close off parts of Asia into a bloc that excludes the United States, whether that's American influence or American military transit or American commercial interests. But it's also important to recognize that China can actually achieve closure through subtler 21st century means that are themselves technological rather than territorial. And there, we need to be attuned to China's attempts to build digital infrastructure in especially allied nations that could then be used as a tool of political coercion and to undermine the political independence of those states, in effect creating a different type of closure, of closed information systems, of exported censorship, and also of siphoning of that data that might be transmitted in other countries back to China for its own governmental use.
Let me ask about a different great power competitor, and that's Russia. What would your openness strategy have us do in dealing with the Kremlin?
Russia poses a very different threat to openness than China does. And primarily, it poses a threat because of the way that it menaces the political independence of the United States and also of some of our allies and partners in Europe. So an openness strategy, first of all, seeks to preserve favorable power balances in Europe. And that shouldn't be hard to do because Russia is itself a power in decline. This has been true for several decades now, and it's all the more true amidst the COVID pandemic and the way in which that has really hit Russia hard and also resulted in a collapse in oil prices with very negative consequences for the Russian economy. So that means strengthening NATO and ensuring that it has the ability to continue to deter any Russian probes that might be in the offing. But it's also important to look beyond the military threat that Russia might pose, because that really isn't the most consequential one. As we see quite vividly in the United States right now, Russia is engaged in an ongoing effort to meddle in our elections, and the United States is really ill-equipped to respond. So we need an integrated strategy that can combat foreign interference, not just in the United States, but also when it menaces our allies and partners overseas. That means being better able to identify incursions when they occur, to publicize them, to work more closely with tech companies in order to make sure that Russia cannot use, for example, social media as an inroad into American elections, and also to think about the types of proportionate responses the U.S. should be prepared to threaten and also enact against Russia in the event that it continues to meddle and subvert the political independence of our democracy or of other democracies.
Okay, so I take your point about the need to tackle new problems. So at this point, since they're several years old, they're sort of oldish new problems. But it sounds like when it comes to NATO, your openness policy is more along the lines of a continuation or a reinvigoration of policy, not a rejection of that policy. Is that correct?
Well, an openness strategy recognizes that many of the 21st century's most consequential challenges will not themselves be military in nature. So that means a few things as it relates to NATO. In some cases, it means that NATO should itself be the vector for cooperation to defend against new forms of threats. For example, in the cybersecurity space, NATO could extend its Article 5 commitment to cover attacks on critical infrastructure, even if those are cyber attacks, which can themselves have strategic effects. But in many other cases, allies that find themselves in NATO may want to join with the United States and other partners as well in defense of openness. And the United States should be willing to look beyond NATO as one construct among many in building coalitions of countries that can advance the types of new forms of governance that we seek, whether that's in the tech space or in the climate space. So those allies will remain absolutely central to the United States' pursuit of an open world, but NATO itself as an institution will not always be at the center of those efforts.
Let me ask you about two other foreign policy persistent problems, Iran and North Korea. A number of different administrations have broken their lances on trying to solve those challenges. What would an openness strategy suggest for dealing with the regime in Iran or the regime in Pyongyang?
So those are different problems. And in both cases, the goal of the United States should be to nudge those countries in the direction of openness, but also recognize the extent to which American interests are in fact engaged in those broader regions. So to begin with North Korea. Certainly, North Korea is a very closed regime, although it doesn't threaten closure beyond its own borders. And in many ways, the greatest threat that is posed by the regime in North Korea is the one that it poses to our allies in the region. So an openness strategy would set out to continue diplomacy with North Korea towards the long-term goal of denuclearization. It would work with our allies to strengthen deterrence on the Korean Peninsula and in Asia more broadly to prevent North Korea from pursuing any kind of aggressive action. And it would see this as a potential opportunity to cooperate with China in order to rein in the North Korean nuclear program and to prevent it from further destabilizing the region. On Iran, Iran is an interesting question because it does in some ways at least have the potential to threaten international waterways and specifically in the Strait of Hormuz. And so while an openness strategy does not envision a Middle East that is itself entirely free and open, it does recognize the potential challenge to international commerce that would come if Iran were able to successfully close off those straits. And as a result, it seeks to build a multilateral coalition to try to keep those straits open. And it would also, of course, engage in the diplomacy necessary to keep the Iranian nuclear program in the box, so to speak, again, recognizing that that is an area where great power cooperation might actually be possible, not only just with China, but also with Russia.
Let's flip the switch. You and me are right in an open world that openness has its own conceptual limits and represents a necessary but insufficient strategic objective for the United States. Not too many books I read in which the authors admit their limitations to what they're proposing. So walk me through that, Rebecca. What are the conceptual limits that you see in an openness strategy?
So let me answer what the conceptual limits are, and I'll also highlight what the practical limits are, because I think we need to be clear-eyed about those as well. So conceptually, it's important to realize that an openness strategy is a prescription for international openness. It is not a prescription for domestic openness. And that distinction is really important because the United States can seek open and transparent interactions between states and via open and transparent international institutions. And it can even seek beneficial economic interdependence without mandating that the United States itself be completely open domestically. So what that means is that the United States can pursue an openness strategy without throwing open its borders to unfettered immigration. That is not required for the success of this strategy. The United States can pursue an openness strategy without opening up its markets, without any limitations. And indeed, an openness strategy is consistent with the preservation of significant resilience in American markets and supply chains. And also, given emergency situations like the pandemic that we're experiencing now, an openness strategy also allows for the idea that significantly more domestic closure may be necessary as an emergency measure, but not as a blueprint for the future. So that's a really important distinction. I think the other distinction to realize in terms of limitation of the openness strategy is that precisely as you said, this is not a prescription for every element of American foreign policy. This is a prescription for how the United States can create the conditions for foreign policy success by preserving an international system that is friendly to our interests and our values. Now, in terms of the more practical limitations, I think we have to look ahead to the November election and recognize that for many of the reasons we've already discussed, a Trump administration is probably not going to accept the strategy, certainly not in its entirety, although it should think seriously about doing that if it's serious about competing with China. But even if a Biden administration decided that an openness strategy was the one that it wanted to pursue, it would still face significant headwinds. And the reason for that is that the United States is in the midst of a four-part crisis at home. We have a public health crisis in the form of the COVID pandemic. We have a racial justice crisis. We have an economic crisis. And we have a climate crisis, as much of the country is quite literally on fire. And so the idea that the U.S. is going to be able to engage in long-term strategy development and execution amidst all of this that is going to be quite literally in the president's inbox when he comes in a new administration, it's going to be a real challenge. And I think it will also create a temptation to just default to old ways of doing things, and the sort of restorationism by default would be a major risk.
Well, let me sort of play this out, because what I've heard you say a lot in terms of the strategy of openness is working with others and leveraging the power of others. But that leads to an important question, which is, to what extent are others interested in working with us? Now, I have sort of immediately in mind that the United States, to much of the world, looks like a country that is unable to handle the challenge of COVID-19. It is a country that is, you discussed in the book, deeply riven by partisan politics. So why are you confident that other countries are ready to sign up for what looks to be an American-led foreign policy initiative?
Well, Jim, I think if you look internationally, you can see that there is a battle underway between forces of openness and forces of closure, in which the United States plays a very important role, but certainly doesn't play the only role. So in particular, you see our democratic allies, especially Germany and Japan, themselves fighting really hard for openness, but struggling to do so as the United States retreats. Their task is made all the harder by the fact that China and Russia are increasingly cooperating for closure. You also have states like India, whose interests don't neatly align either with openness or closure, in the sense that it is a democracy and increasingly, especially after the recent border skirmishes with China, supports the idea of a free and open Indo-Pacific of the kind that the United States has talked about, but also Japan has talked about quite a bit. But at the same time, some of its domestic policies, especially around cyber sovereignty at home and prolonged internet shutdowns, make its internet governance preferences look more like what China wants to do. So what all of this amounts to is a complex international landscape where there are many countries that would be eager to cooperate with the United States towards openness, not because it would be some favor to the United States, but because it is in their own interest to achieve certain forms of openness. But it's also important to recognize that the coalitions that favor openness are going to be different in different areas. So we might be able to bring India along in our security conception of what an open Asia ought to look like, but it might not come along in terms of our ideas of technological openness. So we need to be sensitive to those distinctions and to engage in the energetic diplomacy that's going to be required to understand where our interests for openness do intersect with other countries and where they don't, and to make sure that we can push for an open world accordingly.
I take that point, but it would seem to me that national interest includes a lot of things, and many countries are interested in help to deal with COVID-19. They're interested in help to develop their economies. China has, as you know, been fairly forward-leaning in recent years with its Belt and Road Initiative. It's gone around the world and underwritten a lot of infrastructure projects that on sort of normal cost-benefit bases don't seem to make a lot of sense, but it's built a lot of support for China Chinese policy. Isn't that going to be in the way of the openness policy that you propose, given that Washington seems to be in exactly the opposite situation? We're deeper and deeper in debt. There's a lot of pressure going to be on the federal budget going forward. And we've been cutting back on a lot of our overseas initiatives.
Well, certainly the U.S. can't do this alone. And in particular, the U.S. federal government can't do this alone. So this gets us back to the importance of allies and partnerships, because we have many allies who themselves have fared much better in terms of their COVID recoveries, whose economies are, you know, growing or at least not shrinking at quite the rate that ours are, and who are also very technologically capable. So an openness strategy can only succeed if it tries to marshal the capabilities of those allies towards the ends of openness. So here you can think about Japan, which has itself been very interested in development-based alternatives to BRI and can be an important part of our attempt to create competitive alternatives for states so that they don't only have one option in deciding who's going to build their infrastructure. It creates alternatives to the Chinese option, which is a really important part of keeping the world open. At the same time, the U.S. is also going to have to build and pursue new forms of partnership with its own private sector and also with private sectors in other nations. And here you could think about the arguments that have been going on about 5G development. The United States has been pressuring many allied states, but also non-allied states, to not accept Chinese 5G digital infrastructure. The problem is we haven't been consistent in providing a strong alternative to those countries. But by working with other nations, nations like NATO allies, but also Finland and Sweden and Israel, the United States can actually pioneer a 5G partnership that does provide strong alternatives to countries. So again, the goal in all of these instances isn't that alternatives to China be exclusively American. And it's also not that the US-backed alternatives prevail in every instance. The goal in many cases is diversification, competition, and options for other states so that they're not forced into accepting Chinese infrastructure if they don't want it and the coercion that might come along with it.
I take it, Rebecca, that you see an openness strategy as being one that requires American leadership. You talk a lot about the United States trying to leverage the abilities of others. And if I have that correct, then I would ask the following question, because I suspect there are a lot of people out there listening to us who might say, well, that's really too ambitious. You know, we're a country whose relative power in the world has gone down. We have lots of problems here at home. And I will note you discuss them quite ably in the book, so that's not news to you. But they would sort of say, you know, it's just, we don't have it anymore. We should be focused, you know, here at home. And, you know, it boiled down into the sort of argument, you know, let the world fend for itself. We're tired. Or if you want to go sort of the academic route, as both of us are academics by training, you know, you invoke talk of offshore balancing and sort of, you know, we don't need to be that involved overseas because most of what happens over there doesn't really affect us here at home. How would you answer people who sort of come at this issue from that perspective?
Well, there is no question that the United States faces an enormous task of domestic renewal ahead of it. And indeed, an openness strategy cannot succeed without some measure of domestic renewal. So what that means, of course, is getting the COVID pandemic under control at home through a more effective national COVID response. It also means investing in the American people, the American economy, and the American democracy through such measures as infrastructure building and better healthcare and better K-12 education. But another thing the United States is going to have to do in order to operate at its full capacity overseas is bridge the gap that divides the U.S. tech sector from the national interest and find a way that we can leverage our domestic innovation base for the national interest and for national security overseas. But getting our domestic house in order is necessary, but it's frankly not sufficient for the type of security and prosperity that the United States needs. Because this pandemic illustrates really vividly that problems that start overseas don't necessarily stay there. It also illustrates that in the absence of American leadership, nobody else is stepping up to the plate. And so I think that's in many ways the best answer to the argument that the United States should retrench from global leadership, because there is no one else to take the United States' place. And we've just seen that international institutions are inadequate and international cooperation is elusive in the absence of American engagement. Now, it's also important to recognize, though, that the United States can pursue a very globally engaged strategy while also being more disciplined in its approach. And an openness strategy is very clear that the military should no longer be the leading instrument of American foreign policy, and that much of what the United States has set out to accomplish in the Middle East over the past several decades has not worked, and we really need to refocus our attention on Asia.
I want to just touch on that last point about the militarization of American foreign policy. I think whether you believe that the liberal international order can be reinvigorated, or you need an openness strategy, or you favor offshore balancing strategy, there seems to be a consensus that the United States has relied or come to rely far too much on the military to run its foreign policy. General Mattis, Secretary Mattis, summed it up the best by saying, if you're not prepared to fund the State Department, then you better be prepared to buy more ammunition. But I guess the question I keep coming back to is, we all seem to know this, but we seem to be unable to escape from that sort of cul-de-sac. How do you get beyond the militarization of American foreign policy?
Well, an openness strategy certainly recognizes that much of 21st century great power competition and international politics is not going to be primarily military in nature. And so what the United States needs to do is effectively rebalance its foreign policy toolkit by making a new set of national security choices. So that means, yes, rebalancing away from the military, but someone else needs to pick up that slack. And that means making the United States much more capable when it comes to diplomacy and development.
Oh, I agree with all that. My question really is one of, how do we get there? Because it seems to me we've been talking about this for a long time, and we seem to be in the same place as when we started this conversation.
Well, maybe we have. I don't think that the Trump administration has been particularly serious about making this pivot. So, for example, he continues to rely on demonstrative displays of military force, increasing deployments to the Middle East, at least to deter Iran and such. He has continued to maintain forces in Afghanistan, for example. So I don't think that you see a demilitarization of American foreign policy under Donald Trump. And part of the reason for that is there's also no one else to step in instead, because the Trump administration has simultaneously really gutted the State Department. So I do think there is a fundamental capacity issue here, which is that if we are serious about moving away from military force as the leading instrument of American foreign policy, first, we need a different strategic framework that militates towards a different set of choices in terms of how we go about achieving our aims overseas and what we define those aims as. But also, we need a reinvigorated State Department that is actually capable of picking up a leadership role in American foreign policy and engaging in the type of really energetic diplomacy that we're going to need if the U.S. is to build a coalition that favors openness and favors an open world.
On that note, I'll close up the President's Inbox for this week. My guest has been Rebecca Listener, Assistant Professor in the Strategic and Operational Research Department at the U.S. Naval War College. As I said at the outset, Rebecca is speaking on her own behalf, not for the Naval War College or the U.S. government. Her new book with Mira Rapp Hooper is called An Open World: How America Can Win the Contest for 21st Century Order. Rebecca, thank you for joining me.
Thanks so much, Jim.
Please subscribe to the President's Inbox and Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and leave us a review. They help us get noticed and improve the show. As always, opinions expressed in the President's Inbox are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's episode was produced by Zoe Collins with senior producer Jeremy Sherlick. Zoe did double duty as our recording engineer. Special thanks go out to Margaret Gatch for her assistance. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening.